Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We kick off this hour of epic fantasy stories about young chosen ones with grave destinies with a globally recognizable tune. If you hear that music and are immediately taken to another world, one where magic is real and dragons roam the earth and kids fly around on broomsticks, you are a Harry Potter fan. You may also be taken back to a time 20 years ago when you watched the movie, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, for the first time, and the first time you heard these words spoken on screen.
You're a wizard, Harry.
I'm a what?
A wizard, and a thumping good one, I'd wager. Once you trade up a little.
No, you've made a mistake. I mean, I can't be a wizard. I mean, I'm just Harry. Just Harry.
The movie premiered 20 years ago this month. When production of the film began, J.K. Rowling's books about an orphaned wizard and company were already a global phenomenon. A big screen adaptation seemed inevitable, but also challenging. There was the issue of world-building, as well as casting young kids in roles they would play for more than a decade. So to helm this daunting project, the studio turned to a director who thought he'd lost the job to Steven Spielberg. Chris Columbus had already mastered the art of working with young actors, having directed Home Alone and Mrs. Doubtfire. With Chris on board, a cast of talented kids, and veteran actors like Alan Rickman and Dame Maggie Smith, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone opened number one at the U.S. box office and number one globally, raking in $317 million domestically and $974 million at the worldwide box office, according to Forbes. Its follow-up, The Chamber of Secrets, which Columbus also directed, ensured the series was in it for the long run by bringing in $878 million worldwide. On New Year's Day 2022, Columbus and the Potter cast will reunite and celebrate 20 years since the first installment in an HBO Max special titled Return to Hogwarts. Earlier this month, Chris Columbus celebrated the milestone with All of It and took calls from his fans. The story goes that Chris first got into the book series on the recommendation of one of his kids. So I started by asking him which kid and how did they convince him.
Well, it was my daughter, Eleanor, who is the oldest. She was 11 years old. Well, she was 10 at the time. She tried to convince me to read Sorcerer's Stone. I refused. I just wasn't interested. I said, I'm not really that interested in doing a fantasy film. Then she tried to convince me to read Chamber of Secrets and Azkaban. Finally, after Prisoner of Azkaban, I relented and read all three of the first books in a weekend. And I immediately said, I have to direct these movies. I see these movies. I have a vision for these films. Called my agent and said, I'd love to direct the first Harry Potter film. And she said, you and about 35 other directors. So what was I to do? I said, I'll tell you what, get me the last meeting. After all of the other directors have met with Warner Brothers, I want to be the last person in the room. So she didn't understand why, but she set the meeting for about 10 days later. I took the time to rewrite what was a brilliant script by Steve Clovis, but I wanted to do a director's sort of version of the script filled with, my ideas for sets, camera moves, all of that. I walked into the Warner Brothers meeting with that script. I put it on the desk and I said, this is my vision for the film. You guys can keep it, use it. It's free of charge. And nobody writes anything for free in Hollywood. So I think that was possibly the moment, you know, it still took about 6 weeks before I heard from Warner Brothers, but I think that sort of sealed the deal.
And it's really interesting because I remember watching an interview with you and you said this really came at the right time for you professionally because you'd been working with a lot of big stars and it was almost too easy in a way. So what was going on with you professionally that you wanted to pursue this?
Professionally, things were fine. I just was I just felt that I needed a break from the Hollywood world of filmmaking, and going into the Brit world of filmmaking, it's a completely different situation. Everyone, by the way, so much more professional. None of the adult actors are concerned about whose trailer is bigger. Everybody's just there to essentially deliver a great performance and bring this world to life. It was the greatest experience I've had as a director directing those first two films.
So let's talk about the trio at the center. Harry Potter, Ron Weasley, and Hermione, played by Dan Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, and Emma Watson. If you didn't get that right, this wasn't going to fly. Pardon the pun. What was the casting process?
Casting process at first was fair. We got thousands and thousands back then of videotapes from all around the world. So we had to sort through those, which was time consuming. But then, you know, we did, Rupert and Emma came in for an interview and eventually a screen test. And they were pretty obvious. Mm-hmm. Emma, they both felt like they popped off the page. So that was easy. But then I was watching David Copperfield, a BBC version of David Copperfield. And Dan Radcliffe was in the first 4 minutes or so. That was it. That's all the work he had done. But a light bulb went off in my head, and I said, that's Harry Potter. That's the kid I want for Harry Potter. I told the casting director, I found Harry Potter. It's a kid named Dan Radcliffe. She said, you're never going to get him because his parents don't want him exposed to that kind of fame, and they don't want him to do this. We've already checked. So it was incredibly frustrating, but David Heyman, our producer, went to the theater about a week later and was seated 4 rows behind Dan Radcliffe and his father. So at intermission, being a great producer, David walked up to Dan and his father and arranged for them to come into the office for an interview. And then eventually Dan did a screen test and he got the role.
You'd worked with kids before. You worked with all of these kids. What did you learn about yourself as a director working with kids?
I learned that you don't want to cast kids who have done too much work. In other words, I didn't want, 10 years of, Nickelodeon experience, because then you're not getting an honest, naturalistic performance. Kids, even kids, resort to their bag of tricks. So I wanted kids who had very little or no experience in front of the camera. That was kind of what we did with Macaulay Culkin. He had done Uncle Buck, and I think prior to Home Alone, he had done Uncle Buck. And I think after that, the next picture was Home Alone. And they just, when kids don't have that kind of experience, either with television or other films, they just bring a sense of reality to the proceedings. And that's what Dan, Rupert, and Emma brought, this freshness, and it's all over the first film.
We actually have this. Emma Watson famously said that when she was filming the first movie, she couldn't stop mouthing the lines of other actors during takes. Let's hear her talking about it on Jimmy Kimmel.
This is actually quite traumatic for me because I created issues because of this.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What issues?
I would ruin takes. Chris would be like, cut, Emma, you're doing it again. You're mouthing Dan's lines. And I'd be like, ooh, I'm so sorry. Oh, I feel so bad. But like, I couldn't help myself. It was like, I was such a loser. I really love those books. I really wanted to do my job well, and I kind of overdid it.
Sounds like you were also having to teach them a little bit along the way.
Oh God, I essentially became the fourth actor on the set. I mean, we shot the first film. You'll see there's so many cuts in the first film because the first couple of weeks, the kids were just delighted to be in this world, and they couldn't believe they were in a Harry Potter film. All of the kids across the board. So they would say a line and it was good, and then they'd look into the camera and smile and look at the world around them. I would be like, guys, you got to keep your concentration. So that was difficult, but it also for me became an acting teacher. So by the time we got the kids to the middle, and each of these movies were shot in 120 days, so that's 300 and some days of shooting. And basically by the time we got to the middle of the second movie, the kids could actually perform an entire scene walking, talking. I didn't have to cut. And by the time we finished Chamber of Secrets, they were, phenomenal actors. And I have to admit, that's probably my proudest achievement of directing those movies, is that they continue to become better actors. When I saw the final film of the series, I just went to the theater to see it. I was living back in America at the time. I was overwhelmed emotionally. I just thought, look at these guys. They've become great. They can stand, you know, stand alongside Alan Rickman and Maggie Smith, and they're just as good. And it was a really heartwarming kind of experience.
My guest is Chris Columbus. He directed Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. We got a lot of calls, Chris. Let's go to Maria on line two, calling in from Central New Jersey. Hi, Maria. You're on the air.
Hi. So 20 years ago, I was working in the Lower East Side at the Settlement House, and I was working with kids who were just brought over. A lot of them couldn't speak English so well. You know, many of them were living in boarding houses while their parents were trying to find work. And so we had a group where we would talk, and the one thing that unified the group, and because they were from different parts of China, but also there was Latinos, it was a very diverse group, but the one thing that really united them was the Harry Potter book. So we were able to draw a lot of values and talk about them and use them. So then when the movie came out, most of them had never been to a movie. Wow. In a movie theater. They didn't even have TVs. And so we all went as a group, and it was magic. And I still get tears in my eyes thinking about it now, what it meant to those kids to have such an escape into a fantasy world when their lives were so hard. They were struggling so much, but to have this escape into Harry Potter and then to get to see it in the movie theater, it was magical. And so I just thank you so much for giving kids that escape and that wonder and that joy.
Maria, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you so much for that. That's great. Yeah. I mean, Harry Potter at its heart is really kind of a wish fulfillment story. You know, Harry's living a pretty rotten life mm-hmm. at the beginning of the film, and he's called to Hogwarts. And the clip you played, he realizes he's a wizard. Every kid's fantasy would be to go to Hogwarts. Mm-hmm. I was 40 something when I directed that movie, and I kind of wanted to go to Hogwarts. So.
Let's go to Nicole calling in from Queens on line four. Hi, Nicole. Thanks for calling All of It. You're on the air.
Hey there. What an honor. My husband's a film professor, and he's lecturing right now, so he would probably be way more excited to be talking to you, though I'm super excited. So that's just saying a little bit. I fabricated a question for the screener, even though I really didn't have a question. I actually just had a comment. But just in case they wanted a question, I had one in my back pocket.
It's all good.
But what I wanted to say is, I have four children. We had four kids in 5 years, and I am an avid reader, and I refused to read the books or watch the movies when they came out because my lifelong dream was to have a family of my own and explore so many great movies and books with them in real time. And so when they became old enough, when my youngest was, when she finally got to be three, you know, it was probably too young, but my oldest at that time was eight. And I said, we're all going to read Harry Potter. And we started word for word. I read from the beginning to the end. And every time we got done with the book, we watched the film. And it was magic. I mean, I just can't say anything more than just magic. And what you've done to ingrain yourself as part of people's family fabric is just so great. And I don't think you quite understand what you've done for families in terms of escape, that we've gone to back to them during the pandemic as a way of remembering a place of safety and a place of magic in a time when it's been very unmagical. And I just wanted to say thank you for your artistry and thank you for listening to your daughter. Kids are always right, so you should have listened a little sooner. But still,
Nicole, thank you so much.
Thank you. That is great. Yeah, I have four kids of my own, and it was, you know, I was making the movie for them, for the future, and I didn't realize at the time, because at the time there was a tremendous amount of pressure in terms of, I realized that as soon as I got the job, I was elated for maybe 25 seconds, and then total anxiety and fear set in. And I thought, oh God, what have I gotten myself into? If I fail, I'm going to have to go into the witness protection program because everyone is going to want to kill me. So every Potter fan. So it was, you know, my kids kept me going during that time. And it really, and having four kids and bring this, it was the only time in my life that I was cool with my kids because I was directing Harry Potter. Before and after, forget about it. But that was truly a magical experience for me as well. So thank you so much for that.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest this hour is Chris Columbus. We are talking about Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone on the 20th anniversary of it being released in theaters. Chris on line one from Manhattan has been holding for a long time, so let me get to him. Hi, Chris. You're on with Chris.
Hey, how's it going? Nice to be here. So I have just a couple of things for you, Chris. One, thank you for all your movies. I know we're talking about Harry Potter, but you have given us some of the greatest movies that I think my generation, you have really given us so much that even the younger generation, you know, coming after us is actually watching it and enjoying it. So it's really cool to see, like, my nieces and nephews watching some of those movies that I got to enjoy growing up. But for me, it's a little bit different. So a lot of people got to read the books before watching the movies. I actually watched the movies first, and I got hooked on that first movie so much that I was watching it with my brother, and I didn't want to watch it. I was reluctant at first. You know, I was in my 20s, and I'm like, I'm not getting into this. This is for little kids. And he said, just give me 5 minutes. Give me 5 minutes. Watch the movie. If you don't like it, we'll change the channel. And about 10 minutes later, he changed the channel, and I lost it. I said, what are you doing? Put it back on. And that was it. I was hooked, and I went and read all of the books after. So thank you for really, you know, touching a lot of different people out there with your vision and your artwork. So thank you. I did have a question, and I wanted to ask you about a possible future movie, maybe with The Cursed Child being out, working, with the original cast again. Is that something that you would be interested in, something that's in the works? And if not, I think it needs to be.
Chris, you volunteer to take calls from New Yorkers. We guess they have the questions.
Hey, I lived there for 17 years. I'm prepared.
Okay, good.
No. I've said it. I've done a bunch of interviews. A couple have been published the last couple of weeks, and all of them have touched upon Cursed Child. And I mentioned it, and I said it would be a dream come true for me as an obsessive fan of cinema, to see the original cast members reunited, and they're the perfect age to play these roles. I see those two movies. It would be two movies based on the length of the plays. I see them in my head. I visualize them the same way I did 20 years ago when I first got the job. So I would love to do that. I'm sure there's some complications, some issues. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But it's a mission of mine. So let's see if it happens.
Thanks for calling in, Chris. So it's, you know, it's interesting. He made the point that this is touching on all kinds of generations. Down to today, I don't know if you're aware of it, but have you seen these TikToks of people recreating one particular scene towards the end of the film when the main trio are playing that giant game of wizard's chess? Have you seen these at all?
Not only have I seen them, I had an interview last week with Harry, which I didn't know existed, Harry Potter influencers. and so I did this interview with these two women, and one of the women said, will you do this TikTok with me? And so basically I'd forgotten I didn't forget the scene, but I forgot the exact words of the scene. So I did a TikTok. It's out there somewhere, and it's probably the first and last TikTok I'll ever do.
Well, let's actually, for people who haven't, for the uninitiated, let's hear the actual scene from the movie.
Once I make my move, the queen will take me. Then you're free to check the king.
No. Ron, no!
What is it? He's going to sacrifice himself.
No, you can't! There must be another way!
Do you want to stop Snape from getting that stone or not? Harry, it's you that has to go on. I know it. Not me, not Hermione, you.
And let's hear a bit of the video that started all. Here's TikTok user Kimberly Pizzo recreating the scene, playing all the parts herself.
Once I make my move, then you're free to check the king. No, Ron, no!
What is it? He's going to sacrifice himself.
No, you can't. There must be another way. Do you want to stop Snape from getting that stone or not? Harry, it's you that has to go on. I know it. Not me, not Hermione, you.
It's so funny.
Classic. Oh, I love it.
Let's go to another call. Karina is calling in from Berkeley Heights, New Jersey, on line two. Hi, Karina. Thank you for calling All of It.
Hey, guys. How are you? Chris, congratulations. 20 years. That's amazing. That's so exciting. Thank you so much.
Shocking.
I know. My son is 22. I know. He graduated from college, and I remember, you know, cuddling up and reading the books with him. So much joy you brought, you know, to everybody with the first two films and introducing the actors, you know. So congratulations again.
Thank you.
But my question is, my question is regarding the special effects. You know, I wanted to talk to you. What was the process? You know, that must have been such an exciting part, you know, of being able to direct this movie and bring creatures like the basilisk to life and all of that. So I wanted to hear from you on that.
Especially at that time.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Steven Spielberg has been, he's essentially responsible for my career. You know, produced Gremlins and The Goonies. And when I saw Jurassic Park, I talked to him about it, and he made a case for using practical special effects, actually building the creatures and combining those with digital effects. By doing that, it creates more of a reality for the audience. So, yeah, we did build an actual basilisk, and it's in several scenes. And then there is a CGI basilisk, and they merge together beautifully. And it also helps the actors a great deal, because the actors, you know, they're kids, and they don't, you know, none of them have done a big visual effects movie before. So they actually have something tangible to work with. So the reactions become very real. And it's like the chess scene that we were just talking about. The chess pieces were all built. I mean, it was a stunning set, and we use very little CGI on that sequence, and I think that's why the kids' performances are so good in that scene.
When you think about the film, is there a particular moment in the film that you're proud of as a director?
I had to beat myself up and say to myself every day, every moment has to be great. You know, that's what you strive for. Trust me, every moment's not great in my eyes, because I'm very self-critical, but that's what you go for. When we knew, even in the very early stages, the first scene that we shot was the final scene at the train station at Hogwarts. And it's when the kids are leaving Hogwarts. And if you look closely, it was Emma's first day of shooting. And we wanted to be faithful to the book. And in the book, Hermione has two protruding big front teeth. And so we made a set of prosthetic teeth for Hermione. She's wearing them in that scene, but she could barely speak. And that's the only scene in the film she's wearing them. It's very difficult to tell. But at that moment, Rupert says something to Harry, to Dan, to the effect of, are you excited about going home? Don't quote me on this. But Dan's reaction, camera dollies into his face, and he says, I'm not going home, not really. And at that moment, you know, I had tears in my eyes. I was getting choked up. I looked over at the producer, David Heyman. He had tears in his eyes. And we had this moment where we thought, this film's going to be great. Mm. And Dan Radcliffe, on his first day, tapped into that. Even with all the craziness of these kids not being able to concentrate, something beautiful happened at that moment.
Who has been the most surprising Harry Potter fan? The person who just fanned out in front of you and you did not expect it?
I don't know, really. It's interesting, because it's always, I mean, every person I talk to wants to discuss Harry Potter, people I meet for the first time. It's really an interesting collection of people, but the goal was always to make these films feel timeless. So, and in that respect, the films have a real sort of honesty about them. And I think that the timeless quality is what makes people watch them today. So having fans like, you know, that come up to me and they're 8 years old is just remarkable.
That was my conversation with Chris Columbus, director of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, which turned 20 years old this month.